Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Tangential Banter. My name is Ben Mell, and as always, I'm here with my co-host, Jack Korzenowski.
Ahoy there, y'all.
Well, Jack, we have a special one here today, a long-awaited party, one might say.
Yes, it's a guest that Ben and I have all been waiting for.
Ben and I, well. With us today, we have our good friend, compatriot, Terry Coons. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Yeah, greetings, Earthling. Glad to be with you.
Glad to have you, Terry. Finally have you, actually. We've been talking about having you on since before we even started the podcast, I do believe.
Well, it is great to be had.
So for those who don't know the context, Jack and I both met Terry through our church, and we've all been in a small group together for, going on 7 years now, I think.
Something like that, yeah.
And so that was the origin of the podcast, is Jack and I would have discussions about all sorts of esoteric topics when there were free moments in small group, and sometimes when there weren't free moments. And so everybody was like, why don't you guys start a podcast? Because there would usually be a group of people standing around listening to us talk. And so Terry kind of knew about the types of conversations that we had before the podcast ever came into being. And it was one of the, you could say, one of the drivers for launching the podcast.
Yeah, I nagged you to get started.
So we actually had a number of special, what we wanted to do at the beginning was have basically everyone from small group on at different points in time with a special segment. And so we brainstormed some for Terry. And the first one that that came up was that we wanted to have an episode called Dysentery, where we would invite Terry on and then just like badmouth him in a fun, you know, joking sort of way.
Roast
like
him.
Like a roast, yes, with very bad insults, like not insulting insults that just are made up on the spot. But he couldn't respond. It would just be like this really one directional roast.
Just has to sit there and take it.
Yeah. I don't know how that never got off the ground.
For some odd reason, that wasn't really enthralling to me.
I think to your point, Ben, I think it was just the name. It was just the pun.
It was literally coming up with a segment to match the pun of dysentery. Yeah.
Right.
And then we had another segment that we thought of called Terry Tory or Terry's Tories, which I think was going to be like a geography segment.
Oh, was it? Where,
if I remember correctly, it was something to do with nationalities or maps.
Geography. Yeah. I like that idea.
And then there's another one I have in my notes here. This is from 2019. There was an idea for one called Terry-dactyl. And I don't know what that one was about. If that was like archaeology or paleontology or something, but wow. So all that
to say, I think we're just brainstorming plays off my name and trying to come up with a concept that would kind of fit.
Yeah, but that's the fun.
That is the fun. I'm also seeing some of the other segments we had for some other people in our group that I think we should try to make happen. That was kind of fun. Had one for Joe Pruckler, Jordan Stone King, Kate Samick.
Yep. Yeah, we should make those happen. I mean, we do. I know Jordan and Kate are no longer live in town, but we can. That's the beauty about doing this online, is that doesn't matter. Granted, with Jordan, we'd have quite the time zone difference,
Actually, though, our normal recording time might not be too bad because he's like 13 or something hours ahead. So.
Okay. So it'd be doable. And if we had to shift a little bit to accommodate, it wouldn't be that bad.
Right. Yep. I'll have to ping him and see if he wants to do that. Okay. So anyway, that's kind of the history of how we got here. Terry, anything you would like our listening audience to know about you before we dive into our topic?
Oh, gosh, I don't even know about me. No, I'm kind of a stream of consciousness guy. I really don't know what's coming out of my mouth until it's out there, which kind of makes me dangerous and mildly amusing at times. But yeah, I think that's all that needs to be said.
I'll give a couple more connections just for people who are trying to put the pieces together here. So Terry and I have often said that we're brothers from other mothers, even though we're separated by a couple decades in age. And Terry was also the officiant for my wedding with Sarah. So if you attended that, you've met or at least seen Terry. And if you haven't, then you know who he is now a little bit.
Yeah.
And also, you are a history buff. Read lots
very
of
much.
Biographies and war stories and stuff like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yes. But I am dressed now, so I'm not in the buff right now.
We could maybe come up with a... We'd have to find a pun that matches that, and then we could actually legit have a Terry-related segment where he just... It's like a specialized segment. I like that.
Okay.
I feel like I'm just going to sit here like adults trying to think of puns if I don't just move on. So,
right.
Well, let's move on.
I'll move on. I can move us on, Ben. So I can do the official. Okay, everybody. I have official intro to our first segment, this very special segment. It's a moment that's been a long time in the making. Ladies and gentlemen, it is time to enter the territory.
Territory.
And
nailed
go.
It. Wow, that's. I'm just gonna applaud.
That is pretty impressive.
Just be careful to not say the name again. Otherwise, it will play it every time we say the name.
Nice.
So if I said territory, it would play. Sorry, Jack, I had to try it.
Wow, Terry, you have now set a record as the first person on the show, including Jack and I, to have your own personal introductory sound clip.
Pretty impressive. It's worth the wait. That's all I got to say.
And you're worth it, Terry.
Oh, man.
So this first iteration of Territory is going to...
Territory.
Oh, now you've done it.
Going to not be specialized in any way, but we do have a topic that Ben thought of, and it certainly is... One that's going to, I think it's a very good thinking question. So Ben, I'll let you bring the question up.
Sure. So the question that I have in mind is essentially, what if something that exists today had never been invented? And specifically, the first thing that came to mind was, what if movies hadn't been invented, or moving pictures? Which, for those of you who maybe hadn't put the pieces together, because I hadn't until about a month ago, movie being a contraction of movie picture, or like a nickname for moving picture, where that came from. So anyway, that was just the thought that crossed my mind. Is like, what would the world look like if movies or film didn't exist? And I have some thoughts I can share on that. And then certainly would welcome any additional thoughts that sparks for either of you in terms of movies particularly, or if it takes you down a path of something else not existing in our world, that would be welcome as well.
A tangent, but, if you will.
A tangent. It would be the perfect place for tangent. So when I say movie, I'm thinking very broadly of anything that involves essentially recorded video. So this, or the ability to record video. So this could be TV, YouTube, movie theaters, you know, even recording a video on your cell phone, any of that. And one of the things that came to mind, if that didn't exist, is kind of rewinding the clock to, say, the early couple decades of the 1900s. And I was thinking about, I think it was FDR that did fireside chats by the radio, and how families would gather around the radio and listen to the presidential address in the fireside chat, and thinking, you know, I don't know if much would have changed without video. Like, we would still, it would either be pictures or radio are really the only mass communication methods that we would have.
Or I bet theater would be much more popular.
Live theater, you mean?
Yeah, live theater, where you have to like go to the theater and watch the play or something.
Yeah, and I guess that, so that gets to kind of the two different functions that it provides, at least two, one being inform and one being entertain. And so the live theater gets to the entertain piece, but, you know, if we didn't have YouTube or TikTok or, you know, half of the things on social media, there wouldn't be ads, video ads, all those kinds of things. So there's a level where we could talk about the specific instances that are different, like not having YouTube. But the thing that really struck me is, you know, there wouldn't be Netflix, there wouldn't be streaming services, there wouldn't be, you know, we wouldn't be watching live sports on the weekends. And so if you sum all that up, whether it's for information or for entertainment, there would be so much more free time. Or maybe not even free time, but unconsumed time in the day, because it's still free time. We just choose to fill it with video.
Yeah. Well, and I think the big impact would have been culturally. Think of how movies or video has impacted our culture, from everything from advertising and the impact it's had on our cultural mores and our tastes and everything else to how we've become so, first of all, image conscious and sound bite sensitive. The way that information would be disseminated would be, well, the newspapers would still be a thing and magazines would still be a thing, even though they're both are around in one form or another. They don't have much power in today's culture and information dissemination process. So I think our culture would look radically different than what it looks like today.
I agree. I think radio would be, and I'm guessing podcasts like we're doing right now would have become a thing much earlier on for that, maybe on demand. Like, I think podcasts are the radio equivalent of streaming, because streaming is you get to pick what to watch whenever you want from your whatever selections. Where in podcast is the same concept, but it's audio instead of visual. So I'm guessing that had TV and movies not come around, that the need for podcasts would have been much greater and would have, people would have come up with the idea much sooner. And then perhaps audiobooks as well. Because maybe without movies, people would be much more interested, or TV, people much might have been much more interested in books. But the brain deadness of watching TV is nice.
Yeah.
So maybe, whereas reading requires, like, you have to focus on the paper. It's a lot easier to listen than it is to read. So maybe audiobooks and or recording of books and stuff would have been much more prevalent in early. Same thing with podcasts, much more prevalent in early than it turned out to be.
I would like to believe that we would be more interested in, or more interested in substance. It'd be more substance than there is today in the dissemination of news, deeper quality when it comes to things like the arts, theater, books. Because the one thing that movies and videos have done is conditioned us to receive information in very small bites, you know, 30-second bites. You don't get much substance, you know, there's not much depth that's possible in those short intervals. And I'm hoping, I have no way to verify this, but I would hope that we would have been a culture that was deeper, heftier in terms of substance than what we have today.
Yeah,
I think it sounds like I'm kind of down on our culture today, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, I actually see, I agree with you, like, maybe we have hope for humanity, but I'm guessing not. I'm guessing that without TV or movies, we would have found a way to, we would have found another form of entertainment that fulfilled the needs that TV and movies do without us being, well, I guess I'll be more refined now. We would have figured something else out to be just as lazy and unrefined.
Well, so that's a couple of things that came to mind on that front, Jack, are one of them, if we had all that, I'll say, societal energy and bandwidth to try to develop some sort of a remote information or entertainment medium. I was thinking, like, what would we have developed, like smell-o-vision or something where it could, like, instead of seeing grass, you could feel what laying on grass was like somehow, you know, or like the different senses being engaged instead of visually. But I also think you mentioned theater earlier, and I think one of the consequences would have been that in-person events, whether informative or entertaining, would have a much more central place in society today. Like, I think if you look back to the time period I mentioned, the early 1900s, late 1890s, you know, fairs were a big thing, circuses were a big thing, you know, people were going to opera or whatever. If you look back to ancient times, right, Greeks and Romans, they had theater and the Olympic Games and the Colosseum, all those kinds of things. So I feel like there would have been a much greater emphasis on those sorts of things. And I honestly feel like there's kind of a trend in that direction right now. If you look at ticket prices to get into any live event, whether it's a concert or a stand-up comedian or a football game, they're all going through the roof. And maybe that's because people are valuing them more. It could just be because there's a limited number of seats and our population keeps going up. So, you know, demand keeps increasing, but supply doesn't grow. I don't know, but those are just a couple thoughts I had.
The thing that, because the nice thing about TV that I'm thinking of and movies is that you get this really cool experience that you don't have. I mean, movies are a bit of a different story because that's an experience to go to the theater. But nowadays, with streaming services being as big as they are, they've replaced going to the movies a lot. So the great thing about TV and movies is that you don't have to go anywhere. You just plop it, like, you just go to the channel or you go to the streaming service and hit play. And so it's a very lazy way of getting good entertainment. I'm guessing that we would have that's a need that even if TV or just video in general or film hadn't come around, we would have still found a way to fill that need, that the laziness of society would have won over. So that's why, again, going back to podcasts and audiobooks, and maybe theater would replace going to the movies. But then if you wanted to, you would have to go to a theater to enjoy it, rather than now you can just plop it in your DVD player, bring it up on your smart TV, and then you can watch something. So the laziness, the lazy factor is, I think, going to be dominant in whatever medium would have come up if TV or film hadn't been invented.
So your perception is that the trend toward ease and comfort would win the day over everything else.
I think so.
Essentially inevitable.
Or at least it would have been a major factor. I mean, you're right. If TV or film hadn't been invented, then people would still have to go to in-person stuff to get the visual entertainment. But there would probably be ways around that where they would either defer to a medium that isn't visual to get their entertainment, or they would find a visual medium that they could enjoy from their home, or at least easily, like pictures or art or something. But art isn't as, it's just like, you know, a static picture that can only do so much to entertain you.
I think you could also have a situation, like I was kind of imagining, you know, the like major court cases where the judge doesn't allow cameras in the courtroom. So you have the courtroom sketch artist or whatever that does a couple stills of what the scene was like. I was kind of imagining that, but like if you had a concert, you could have someone there who's sketching it, and then you could listen live and then see their sketches, you know, because I would assume the internet's still here, just without video. But so you could hear the audio and see sketches live, or I don't know, say it's just a stream of pictures from people who are taking pictures on their phone and then posting them. So there's no video, but you could hear the audio and kind of get a moment by moment glimpse of what it's like.
Could be.
That'd be the most similar to what we have, I think. But I think, Terry, you hit on a good point, which I think I'm curious to get your thoughts on more, which is the extent to which film and video have become a cultural icon, where they, in essence, and maybe it's a chicken or the egg a little bit, but they create this narrative of what we should look like, what we should sound like, how we should live our lives. Yeah. Like they've kind of become this, in essence, a codification of cultural norms in a lot of ways, for good and bad. And I think they both reinforce them and they push them in new directions. So I'm curious if you have any other thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think, yeah, you're right to a certain degree, you know, chicken or the egg, you know, life imitating art, art imitating life. It's there's some of that, I think, but I think that videos and all that's included in that, movies and I would include even broadcast news, although that's drain a bit out of the genre perhaps, but really go a long ways towards defining what our culture looks like, how it looks and acts and responds to life. You know, we have these images broadcast out there, movies that are viewed by millions of people, billions of people probably worldwide, that tell a story about life in America or life in general, that in some cases are quote unquote based on a true story, and we know how accurate or true to life those usually are. But you know, nevertheless, we present a picture of of life in the good old USA or wherever, that have an impact on the way that we then see our own lives. Whether it's measuring ourselves against what we see on TV. Oh, you know, I'm not looking that good. I'm not acting that way. I'm not thinking that way. So I'm going to adjust all of my fashion and thinking trends. And so, yeah, I think that they do have a tremendous impact on the way that we just go about daily living. And we see that, you know, as we, you probably have run up against this in your working with international students and so on, the internationals who come to the United States to go to school, they're looking around for what they've seen on television or seen in the movies. Mm-hmm. And you know, in some cases, it depends on where they go, who they hang with, they find or they don't. And the sad part is that it's representing a very distorted view of life, especially life here in the Midwest where we live. I mean, we. So anyway, it's a long answer to your short question, but I think tremendous impact. I mentioned movies based on supposedly a true story. Well, is that true story shaped in some way by what they've already seen, what's already been absorbed from the movie media already? And so what is true life? I don't know.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought.
So do you think, are you saying, Terry, that you think that these so in this particular example, like the expectations that these people from all around the world, when they come to America and they're expecting to see X, Y, and Z, you're thinking that if film were never invented, those expectations would either be completely gone or at least not as strong?
I would say not as strong, because they would still be receiving information, so to speak, about the United States, about life here, life in general, through the media that they're familiar with, newspapers, magazines, radio. All of those have much limited readership or viewership than the movie industry and what is presented by available videos. And so they would still be receiving impressions, but I don't think that they would be as powerful in shaping culture as the movie industry is now. Video, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And the beautiful thing about film is that it's an all, except for maybe smell and feel, like it engages all of your senses. And I think with sight, with vision, you can, you know, you can paint a much more vibrant picture, pun sort of intended. And it engages the imagination and the brain a lot more than just like auditory or any other medium. And I think that's why films, because the thing is, right, like we have books, we have audiobooks, we have podcasts, but TV and film trumps that. And I think it is the visual. It is the visual element, because it's much more, what's the word I'm looking for? Desirable, or, you know, people much prefer to be entertained visually than any other way, I would say, because it is much more of a, more stimulating, maybe is the word. And so that captures their brains and really, really gets people hyped up.
Well, I think,
I was going to offer the word engaging.
Yeah, I think that's engaging. Yes, good call.
I think stimulate is the right word, Jack, because if you think about the percentage of your brain that does visual processing versus the other senses, I don't know all the numbers, but I know it's a visual processing is a massive chunk of that. The majority of out of the five primary senses that we consider, the brain is spending a lot of its energy processing visual data. And so I wonder if there's an element of visual stimuli engage the largest portion of your brain. And so that provides the most excitement or, you know, vibrant experience or whatever, as opposed to some of the other ones that are, can be done with a lower level of mental engagement, mental effort. And I don't even mean consciously, I mean subconsciously.
That brings up the question of just, you know, is the fact that, because I don't know the numbers, I haven't looked into this, but I would wager that you're right, that that of all your senses, sight has to be the most demanding for brain power and complexity in the brain to do all the processing. So a bigger chunk of your brain and organs has to be devoted to sight rather than smell or taste or feeling or hearing. But does that necessarily mean that it, quote, stimulates you more or engages you more inherently? Because I was trying to come up with an example of, you know, just because a company or some organization, even if it's something like an ant colony, even if it's most of its resources are in one department, that doesn't mean that that department's the most important one. It's just the department that requires the most labor.
Sure. And I guess it depends on how you define stimulation or engaging, because to me, you know, your brain is essentially an organic computer. And so if we're saying that the five senses require memory to operate on that computer, it seems like by definition, the one that uses the most memory is going to be the most stimulating, right? It gives the most pieces of that computer an opportunity to participate in the process. So maybe that's a terrible analogy or a misunderstanding of how the brain works, but that's how I see it. The other thing I was going to point out is that you said that the visual media is the most, engages our imagination the most. And I kind of want to push back on that a little bit, because I think the visual sense is actually the least imaginative. I mean, if we're imagining, if we close our eyes and imagine in our head, then I think you can picture something, like you can see something that you don't see that is highly engaged with your imagination. But I think putting something in front of our eyes that isn't real in a true sense, right? Like, I'll say it this way. Doesn't exist outside of film. I think to our eyes, it is real, right? It's the same as if you're seeing a video of a book, or if you're looking at a book, your eyes are getting the same inputs. And so I think to some extent, the engaging power or the stimulating power of video is a trap. And I think this is why we say that it's not good to just spend your time staring at screens or whatever, besides all the health effects, is because you're actually replacing engagement with your imagination with what your brain thinks is just the real world to some extent. And so I know what you're
talking about.
You're not really building that muscle to imagine a world. You're just like, oh, that's the world, right? Like,
yes. So I want to jump in, because I'm antsy to get this point across. You're right in that if I said it stimulates or engages our imagination, you're right. I think what it does instead is it fills in the gaps. When you're reading a book and you're imagining the scenery or you're imagining the characters, you have the freedom and you have to do the work of actually filling in those gaps of what these people look like or what the scene looked like or what this would look like that. But when you watch a movie, all that work is done for you and you get the whole picture right there presented to you and all the hard work is done. So that's why it's mostly, oh, sweet, I can actually see. You know, people are excited when their favorite book gets turned into a movie because now they can actually see it.
Mm-hmm.
And the downside, I would agree with you, is that now it doesn't leave anything to the imagination. And some things, some of the most entertaining stories, so this is kind of going away from the visual part of the conversation, but there are some stories that, sure, they may be represented visually, either that they're a film or they're a video game, but the actual story of, you know, what actually happened is still left up to the reader's or the player's imagination. And those are much more entertaining media than if they just flat out tell you what happened. You know, that air of mystery, right? Where you get to start, things start popping off in your brain. Maybe this happened, maybe that happened. Oh, but if that happened, then that means this guy was really the bad guy. And, you know, really starts getting your brain juices flowing and you get into it. Whereas if they just say, and so-and-so betrayed so-and-so, and then this happened, but then he was defeated. End of story, done. It's like, oh, well, okay. And the movies are the media representation of that, where they just lay everything out for you and leave nothing to your imagination. And sometimes people are disappointed in that, right? When they say, oh, yeah, I finally get to see something brought to picture and it's not what I envisioned and I don't like it.
So that brings to mind two thoughts. One of them, exactly what you were just saying, is that I'm curious if the people who find themselves disappointed when a book or some other non-visual, let me say it differently,
visual.
Yeah, I mean, books are still visual, right? You're using your eyes to read. I'm trying to think of
you can listen to a book, an audio book, and that you're getting the same information. I wouldn't classify the allure of a book is not the visuals. It's the words, right? That you have to read with your eyes. You can read them with your fingers, reading Braille or listening to them.
So I'll say then a non-semantic communication method, right? So for a book, the medium is visual, but the meaning is in words, right?
Sure.
And for video, sure, you can include words and there's meaning in that, but a lot of it is in the nonverbal. So anyway,
right.
the point that I was trying to make is, I wonder if people who find themselves disappointed in the representation of a book or whatever in film are people who have the most vivid imagination, because they were able to engage with the original source material and they had their own vibrant picture of it in their head. Mm-hmm. And they're like, wow, this is amazing. And so nothing, someone else presents it, like, well, that's not right. That's not what I imagined. And then for the people who don't have that same level of imagination, they're happy to visualize it, right? Because they had no picture in their head. They just had the story, mm-hmm. and they're like, oh man, I wonder what so-and-so looked like, or I wonder what, you know, these mountains looked like. So maybe I'm wildly off base, but that was the first thing that came to mind, is maybe what differentiates people who are happy for how something's presented in film and those who aren't.
I think you're right on. I think that one of the things that I love about reading is it allows it exercises my imagination, and it spurs some juices in my brain, is about the only way I can put it. That you know, as I'm reading about a character, I am in my imagination, I'm painting a picture in my mind of what they look like, what they sound like. That's apart from any description that's conveyed by the words. And so that when we've read the book and then we go see the movie based on the book, we have already in our minds this vivid picture that we love because we love the book, you know, that represents truth, you know, to us. And then we see the movie and that's not right. That's not what they look like. That's not what they sound like. He wouldn't have acted that way. She wouldn't have done that, you know, because our imagination has already trumped the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that on a broader sense with books is the strength of reading as opposed to sitting in front of your device and watching a video or a movie or something, because reading does engage your imagination. It stimulates your brain in ways that movies or videos cannot, and are not even trying to. They're trying to present the broadest version of whoever or whatever is being depicted so that it's accepted and liked by the broadest number of people, so that it does well at the box office and it makes the advertisers happy. So I think there's a big difference right there between the video industry and the publishing industry, or the book industry. Yes.
It kind of makes me think, I'm going to get back to the second point I mentioned earlier, but it kind of makes me think that your brain is always trying to fill, it's always trying to have a signal for every sense. And so when you're reading, you're not really using the full potential of your visual senses. It's like getting less stimuli than expected. And so you're getting the words on the page, but your brain has all this bandwidth to rove around and imagine pictures to represent the concepts that you're reading about. And then when you're watching a movie, you just get it, right? There's your visual capacity is at its bandwidth, because you're looking at an actual image of some kind. Mm-hmm. And so this connects to my second point I was going to make, which is my favorite filmmaker is Christopher Nolan. I think specifically for this reason, because I do not at all enjoy movies that are mindless. You know, the ones that just kind of, they've got a bunch of one-liners strung together or whatever. And unfortunately, they seem to be ones that tend to do well in the box office, where you can kind of throw a bunch of words into a hopper, generate a script, and you're going to make money. But Christopher Nolan has this amazing way to develop a complex plot and a compelling story with mechanisms that confound easy comprehension. And so you're forced to think throughout the whole movie, like, man, how does this fit together? Like, what, where is he going? How does this work? Right? Because there's a lot of mechanics that seem to defy physics. And yet it's all coherent in some way. And so to me, it really gives me the opportunity to think and to imagine in a film format that I very rarely get with other types of movies.
Well, we could keep talking about film, or we could ask the question, you know, what if X hadn't been invented, to about some other invention?
Well, I've got a couple more thoughts if neither of you have anything else to add on film
before we switch. Sorry about that. Yeah, I don't think I have anything that I want to bring up now.
Go for it.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So one of the things I was thinking about is like with YouTube, it's become the go-to source for self-help DIY projects. And so I've just been thinking about how, even as, you know, broadcast video or movies have become a way of influencing culture with just a few hands, on the flip side, how much it's enabled us to help each other more broadly. And I know, Jack, we've talked about this in the past of, you know, solving a problem once and having that documented clearly so that the rest of society and even the world can not have to solve that problem again, was one of the great values that books provided. And now, you know, how much more has video multiplied that, where I can actually, in a minute and a half, watch someone exactly how they access their light bulb on the same car as mine, and which screw to turn and how to unhook it and which size I need and put it back in, right? And I would have had to do a fair amount of reading and research before to get that information put together. So I was just thinking about that element more on the positive side of what video has given us.
Like, as far as instructional videos, those beat written instructions or audio instructions, hands down, not even close, no contest. Because at that point, you don't want, right? You don't want your to rely on your imagination. You want those gaps filled in. Where is this screw this guy keeps talking about? Like, that I need to take out. I can't find it. Then
right. And maybe building off of that, like, how much, you know, with everything that's happened over the past couple of years in Ukraine and now in Palestine and other places, how much more impactful is it when you see video, you know, from someone on the street who's running for their life as, you know, rockets or something are exploding around them, or you hear gunfire, versus just seeing that described in a, you know, say on a front page news, you know, attack in wherever, right? Like, it's a totally different experience where you don't have to imagine it. You're like, wow, this is real. This is what it's like to live in that kind of environment. Like, I can't imagine walking outside of my front door and hearing live gunfire, you know, not just like, okay, I grew up in a small town and you would hear gunshots in the distance on a regular basis. And it would be, you know, okay, so-and-so's target practicing, or, you know, hunting season started. But to know that those gunshots are attached to an ongoing battle slash war, you know, you can actually get a taste of that now with video from people who are there.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that video has done, is it's made the world smaller, you know, and part of that also is the means. It's not just the video, it's the ability to transmit that video almost instantaneously around the world, so that what's happening in Gaza right this minute is on my computer screen or smart TV right this minute. And so the world has become much smaller. And I think there's advantages to that, to have a sense, an understanding of what's going on in the world, that we here in the Shire, you know, live a very insular life, and that there's much going on in the world around us that, you know, there's just much more going on. And the question then becomes, is that really beneficial? And I think yes, to a certain extent, to have a sense of knowledge and even solidarity with, for example, suffering people, oppressed people around the world, as you see their lives being messed up in real time. But also, I think it can be awful confusing, if mainly what is confusing is the way that it's presented. You know, people who have access to that information can frame it to their benefit, right? And so it can be very confusing how to assimilate that information in a helpful, healthy way.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the other things is the level of accountability that it's brought, right? And reduction in crime, which may be leading to a dystopia, but to be used as evidence is so, you know, so incredibly helpful in a way that witness accounts can't match, pictures can't match. You know, just thinking about the number of instances over the past few years that, you know, police misconduct has been documented and brought to light by video that could have easily been dismissed as a he said, she said kind of a situation. And so I think there's a lot of strength in that. And there's been a lot of good done by having that capability that just it's not matched by anything else that we have in our tool set.
Right. And there's no way that any previous media could have even approached its impact.
Yeah. And yeah. I think this all ties back into the point we were kind of making earlier, whereas when as an entertainment media, or not entertainment media, but as a media where you're supposed to rely on your imagination, like reading a story or something, and you want the person who's partaking in the story or whatever it is, you want them to use your imagination. That stimulates them and engages them. Then film or TV may not be the best media, but as when you don't want them to rely on their imagination, you want to fill, they want all the gaps filled in for them because they need those gaps filled in. That's where film and TV reign supreme, where there is no, it's not even a question of, is there a media that does it better, such as storytelling or, you know, reading Lord of the Rings, right? Should we show them what Legolas and Aragorn and Minas Tirith look like, or should we leave that to our imagination? Well, you know, there's some debate as to which way is better, but as far as like, we need to show people what's going on in, you know, Ukraine, or we need to write an instructional video on how to change out like a tractor engine. It's like, well then, like film it. Like, it's not even, there's no question as to if that's the best way of doing it, because you want all those gaps filled in. You don't want there to be anything left to the imagination, and you don't want there to be any ambiguity. Nobody does in those situations.
When you speak of using videos as a reporting tool, you are telling a story. You are seeking to elicit a response. And you're right. There's no better ways of doing that than with video production. Again, my question goes back to those that are telling the story, and what story are they actually telling, and for what purpose?
Right.
In those moments, or along those questions is, I think, really, those are really the critical questions. And
I think it's a couple of things that tie to that thought are, first of all, video is, it's like your own pair of eyes, right? So it's going to reflect the way that you have seen the world as the person directing the camera. And so it comes with that inherent bias, which can be, it can be through unaware, unconscious, or it can be something that you're intentionally trying to push one way or the other, and that influences the outcome. And I think the other piece is, certainly there's that question of, is this done in one cut? Right? Or is this a bunch of rehearsals and takes and whatever? And to what extent is what you are seeing a reflection of the real world versus the doctored version of it in any thing? I think kind of, I can't remember if this connects to what you're saying or not, Jack, but what was coming to mind is the phrases that we have in our own lexicon that kind of reinforce this idea, like seeing is believing, right? Or Pixar didn't happen, that kind of thing, where there is a real degree to which something being put in front of our eyes is the gold standard of reality as best we can define it with our senses. And so I think that idea of information, reality versus imaginative entertainment that's a real factor in that, is that what we see with our eyes is how we define reality in many, many cases.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I've, at least for now, exhausted the things I wanted to say on that topic. So if either of you had things that you wanted to talk about not existing, we could roll one of those up.
Well, Terry made a very interesting question where, what if circles were never invented? And I was not aware that circles had to be invented. So I kind of want to explore what exactly that means. Like, would the not have to be, like, it's a ball, it's a sphere. Or heck, even if you're a flat earther, then it's a disc at least, but both involve circles in some dimension or another. So like, would that mean that, question, if a circle couldn't, like if a circle just didn't exist, right? Then Ben, you're the more, like you're like the engineer in science, you realize that like the planets and stuff form as spheres because that's the way that gravity pulls them into, and has to do with like, you know, the least energy state, yada, yada. But let's say circles couldn't exist. What would the next best thing be that planets and stuff would form into?
Well, real quick, I want to address your first assumption, which is that circles exist and didn't need inventing. And I would argue that objects in the shape of a circle or taking a circular form, whether that be cylindrical or spherical, do exist. The concept of a circle as a purely theoretical or two-dimensional object had to be at least discovered, maybe not invented, but discovered. And we've since used that to better define the world around us. But I do think there, maybe we could answer the question is, what if the circle hadn't been discovered a mathematical or geometric principle? But to answer your question, I think the answer is probably going to be the largest, the polygon with the most number of sides that we could reasonably simply use, right? So maybe an octagon or something would become the best approximation of a circle, and whatever three-dimensional form an octagon creates. What's the term for a shape that is has as many faces as edges?
Ooh, I do not know.
Like a tetrahedron, right? I guess it's not the same number of faces as edges. What am I trying to say? There's a better definition that I can't think of, but like a tetrahedron is one. So it's triangles all joined together, and then a cube is squares all joined together.
Oh, I think I watched a Numberphile video on There's No More.
Oh, a cube is the last one?
I think so.
I think when I kind of tongue-in-cheek offered that that question up there, I was thinking in terms of the simple machines. What if mankind had not recognized the utility of these basic geometric, you know, constructs, and their usefulness in, you know, making life simple? I guess that was what I was thinking of when, and I just wrote circles, wedges down. I couldn't, off the top of my head, come up with any more simple machines, because I guess I'm not that simple. But
good for you.
Yeah. Terry. So that's what I was thinking when I offered that.
So as far as circles are concerned, you're talking about wheels, cogs, gears.
Yes.
Okay. Man, if you want to also include any simple tool like wedges or levers, then I think we'd pretty much still be back in the Stone Age, because that's what humanity was before any of that stuff was invented. We just never would have gotten out of that.
Pretty short discussion, isn't it?
That's just funny.
Okay, so what parts, let's flip that question then. What parts of modern society could still exist without the wheel or levers?
Not a lot. Well, not a lot of stuff exists today without those things, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't another way of doing it.
Would we ex have exercised our collective imagination way back in the day to come up with some things we cannot even imagine today because we don't have to imagine them today?
Could be. Yeah,
Well,
that's a good point. I mean, that's a good question, one that we'd have to seriously consider.
we could still have hot air balloons.
Don't they use a lever in their in the like the pull cord mechanism? But then again, there could probably be a way to do the same thing without a lever. That's the question.
The lever is a device that
Yeah.
makes the most sense because it's simplest, but that's not the only way.
Yeah. So that's
It's
a
just a mechanical advantage, right? It means there is another way to do it. It will take you more work.
Or it won't take you more work, it'll take you more force.
Sure, more force, yes.
It will literally take you the same amount of work in the technical
Yes.
sense.
But the amount of force that it takes may exceed your ability to apply.
Right.
So your
Hence,
level
that
of
is true.
strain increases even if the work is the same.
Right. Because the distance
That
covered
is true.
is less.
Okay, so hot air balloons. That's a real integral part of modern society.
I don't think we can do, well, not airplanes. I was going to say not airplanes, and I guess I'm not 100% sure about that, just because of the propulsion mechanisms all involve either spinning propellers or spinning turbines. I think anything, or not air, literally anything, but most things related to that require something spinning, like a shaft, is going to require a circle.
Okay, but we could use we could still have rockets.
That's true.
True.
Could have rockets, that's a good
True.
point.
So
any
Couldn't
ground,
have trains.
no wheels.
no wheels,
We have to.
anything ground re transportation related would dependent upon a wheel would not be possible.
So we could still
Right?
we could have boats. We could have
Yep.
things on skis.
Perhaps we would have perfected personal flying devices. Maybe Da Vinci would have come up with a workable set of wings that would have been capable of carrying us safely from point A to point B.
And
Hang
they did have
gliders.
rockets back then, so it could be rocket propelled.
Rocket-propelled hang gliders.
Yep.
Here we go.
I love it.
Actually, why don't we do that? That should be a
Yeah,
thing.
just for fun, yeah.
It sounds like a lot of fun.
Oh, dang it. Oh.
We could still have toothbrushes.
Yeah. Maybe we would have
True.
perfected, going back to the locomotion, maybe we would have perfected walkers. Like
Walking devices?
yeah, or like the chicken walkers from Star Wars, the AT-STs, where they don't, or like the AT-AT troop transports, where they don't use wheels, they use like mechanized legs.
Yeah, that's hard. That's maybe a gray area because I feel like they have rotating elements in there still. I guess depends on if your argument is they don't have to go a full revolution, that it's not a wheel or a circle or whatever.
Yeah, but then again, maybe they would find a way to do it without using circular components, or B, even if they did, the chances of them being able to make them without circular components or lever mechanisms is very small.
Right. Yeah. I was thinking, I thought you were talking about, there's videos too that come to mind. One is a guy that makes wind powered wooden sculptures that like walk down the beach. They're not wheels. They're but those, so that's a whole compilation of levers, right? Like, connected together. It's like a 4-bar linkage, just a whole pile of them. There's also like a Swedish guy who has an instrument that he built, which uses, it's very similar approach, a bunch of wooden pieces, and then it more or less is like a gumball machine for steel marbles, but it makes music. So he dumps a bunch of these steel ball bearings in the top, and then they start feeding down through, and they play songs as he
spins it. I think I've seen that too. I mean, that particular one uses steel balls, so that would count that as a circle, but he could use something else in theory.
Yeah. We could still have board games because dice are cubes, not spheres.
Yep. Maybe we could find a way. I mean, they have made vehicles with non-circular wheels that sort of work.
How much do they approximate a wheel?
The wheels are definitely not circular. They're like triangular. They have like rounded edges, so it's not like there's not hard points on them. But no, have you ever heard of they're called I think they're called shapes of constant width. Have you heard of those?
I don't think so.
They're like these they're hard to describe without a picture. But they're like these, they're not spherical, they're not balls, but if you put like, if you put some of them under like a textbook or a glass surface, you can roll this surface around as if it were just rolling around on, you know, ball rollers, nothing special, but it's like these weird tetrahedral shaped, things that look like it shouldn't be rolling as smoothly as they are, but they're rolling as smooth as like balls would. It's hard, again, hard to describe. Look up, for our listeners, look up shapes of constant width. And there's probably a bunch of YouTube videos on it. I'll send you one, Terry and Ben, after this, so you can see. They're pretty interesting. They're one of those things where now that you see it, it makes sense and you can understand how it works. But it's something that I never would have thought of on my own. Maybe my imagination is just limited, and that's why I like TV.
So are these circles and wedges, gears and such, are they fundamental to inventing or imagining the plethora of electronics that we have today? Could have the technological revolution that has given us all of this, things like computers and cameras and could that have somehow arisen without those devices? You know what I mean?
It's hard to say. If we couldn't even come up with a factor to consider is if we couldn't even come up with the concept of a circle.
I know where you're going. I know where you're going.
Yeah, we can't even come up with a circle. There's no way we're going to come up with advanced electronics. But
you've got the raw materials being mined by people with pickaxes being carried to be smelted in, you know, buckets on your head.
it is been a computer.
I mean, to some extent though, like you can see that, not that they actually make them, but you can see that society, right? Like Terry, I think of where we were in Northern India, right? Where it's very impoverished. There are very few, modern conveniences, and yet people have a satellite dish and a cell phone
on their grass hut. Yeah.
Right. So they didn't develop the satellite dish or the cell phone in those conditions, but you can, if you want to see a world where that could be imagined. It does exist on this planet.
Your question of can that stuff have come about, Terry, like could we have invented PCB boards or the cell phone or computers without circular tools or components or levers? My gut says no. Because again, if we couldn't come up with that stuff, one, those things are so useful that trying to do what we do without them is like, I mean, Grant, we had a conversation, you know, so many episodes ago about we don't give the ancients enough credit because we think that because they didn't have today's technology, they couldn't have achieved these great works, even though they obviously did. Or I shouldn't say obviously, even though there have been instances of people doing amazing things with antiquated ancient techniques, or at least the lack of current technology, right? So because of that conversation, I'm actually a bit more hesitant than I otherwise would be to say that no, we couldn't get to modern electronics without circular components or, you know, the lever mechanism. Maybe, you know, maybe the ancients would have surprised me. But I think we could maintain electronics and still have electronics without circular circles or levers, at least some of them.
So I'll push back a little bit. I think it's plausible. I'm not saying it's likely, but I think maybe it would have taken more time, or, you know, there would have had to have been some other sequence of events. But just thinking about the basics of what goes into a digital device, a digital hardware of some kind, it takes electricity of some kind, which you can generate without circles or levers. It takes binary logic, which doesn't necessitate either of those things. I think the real challenge would be aggregating the raw materials necessary and producing the components would be the biggest challenge, right? Like how do you create a glass screen or a microchip or whatever, right? Without some of those things.
Yeah.
Or maybe there's, right. Or maybe there's like two cell phones on the planet because it takes all of us to gather all those materials in some way. And I think we've already identified some fairly plausible things, you know, like obviously did, you know, Egyptians did amazing things, but they still use ramps and whatever else. So it depends on how strict you're being with your interpretation of levers or whatever. But so at some point, if we got enough people and we could do the figuring, which I think we're capable of, then we're really just limited by our materials in many cases. And so get enough people together, dig enough, mine enough ore, it would probably happen.
So what you're saying is if we got enough people together, pounded on typewriters mindlessly, eventually we could come up with a manufacturing process for electronic devices.
I think you may have put words in my mouth there. What was actually coming to mind was like, this isn't really a good analogy, but imagining something like the internet over, like with old telegram machines and telegraph wires, which there's not a, it's all analog, right? But I was kind of taking that same approach of like, could we have gotten to a similar product without the digital element to it, with a more analog element? I don't know. I'm just weird brain bunny trails or tangents.
Well, that's what we're here for. And I would say that after our conversation with your brother about ancient aliens and ancient civilizations and all that stuff, we have to remember that we may, like, you know, that the people without people can do amazing things even without technology. So if we were to take circles and levers out of the equation, I bet humanity could still do some pretty cool stuff.
I think we would see probably like a lot of horses and mules hauling sledges or sleds with a bunch of raw materials on them, right? Like that's what we did before we had effective means of using levers to convert chemical energy into mechanical energy. We took nature's combustion engines and put them to work. Progress would be slow, Terry. I would say that though. Even if the end goal was attainable, it would be slow going.
I would agree with you. I didn't have any, you know, advanced timeline in mind when I was positing that question. I figured that if it would be possible, it would take a bucket load of time for it to occur. But again, just as I kind of have a skeptical view of culture today and its inclinations towards quick and easy entertainment and all this kind of stuff and the stifling of imagination. Again, we wouldn't have movies to distract us back in the day. The collective imagination of humankind may have been capable of doing exceedingly more than we could ever think of or ask for.
Whoa, biblical.
Whoa.
Yeah, actually, I think in a very real sense, a lot of the greatest thinking in human history was done before the modern age because they didn't have the readily available distractions bombarding them that we do. And so if you look back to the classical thinkers or even you could say modern philosophers, not that there aren't great minds today who are still thinking at an extremely high level and putting that to use, but I feel like it's become much more technical, much more pragmatic.
Yes.
And some of those big picture meaning of life questions and wrestlings were not advancing to the same degree that were done in centuries and millennia past. Well, any other thoughts that have come across your minds of things not being invented? I think we covered quite a bit of ground today.
We did, just off of
covered two bunch of ground.
And Jack, just to briefly address the question you raised that ties to our last episode of what if toilets weren't invented? You know, I think maybe there'd be less time spent in the bathroom because you don't have something to sit on.
Well, it's not just the physical porcelain, you know, throne. It's more of like maybe what I should have said was plumbed waste removal.
Yeah.
So, which obviously humanity got along with for the vast majority of our existence up until just like the last few hundred years. At least, I mean, I think there were some plumbing systems in Rome, in Greece, but those were, and maybe other parts of the world, those are the only two cases that I know of, but those were probably isolated to big city centers. And if you were just some guy in the country or in a smaller town or in the equivalent of the suburbs back in those places, you probably didn't have, you know, plumbing, and you probably had to go take care of your business in a more antiquated way than we do today. And I just wonder what the implications of, like, imagine, right, if buildings didn't have toilets or just any plumbed excrement management system, how would that affect like modern building design or modern modern society?
Here's my proposition, because I think this still, we have examples of this still in our current day and age, right? You go to a national park or a state park and they have like composting toilets in a lot of places where it's a pit toilet. So it's not plumbed, but it's essentially built to be able to to digest the waste in a way that can then be handled safely and turned into something else. So what I imagine is each house, you know, back in the day where they had the what the heck did they call it? Basically an outhouse. You'd have a bathroom located a similar distance from the main house with a hallway going back to it, because I don't think we would still accept walking, you know, 30 yards through minus 20 degrees all winter long. I think people would have just adapted by putting in a long, robust hallway with air handling systems to deal with the smell. And then you'd have a self-composting pit toilet.
But what about like a big, what about buildings? Because right now, like, you know, big office buildings or something, or even like stadiums, for example, or skyscrapers have water plumbed systems to flow the poop away. If you didn't have that, what would we have? And would that actually shape how buildings can look? Because you can't, if you don't have a way of getting that, you know, the poop down from the 51st floor in a safe manner, you can't build a skyscraper 51 stories high.
Okay, Jack, but in that case, you have gravity in your favor. So you could leverage, you could do it one of two ways. You could leverage the old castle design with the, what were they called? The toilets on the battlements where you basically just, your butt was hanging out over space and you would, like the excrement went, fell outside of the castle, like into the moat or on the base of the castle.
So you just loaded the trebuchet with it.
Yeah.
Used it.
So you could do that method where it's like an inverted pyramid and each level is slightly farther out than the one below it.
Sure.
The toilets are always on the outer edge. Or you could have imagine like a laundry chute inside of the building on, you know, that's connected top to bottom. But then you could just kind of back up to the laundry chute and, you know, do your business, and then it would all fall down.
Yeah, but then, like, how do you clear, like, if that's in the...
If you just have a big, like, subterranean, like a parking garage underneath, only it's a pooping garage, and then you go in with like, a skid loader and it all out periodically.
I'm just trying to envision the job description for the guy who cleans all that up.
He would be a professional pooper scooper.
He would.
Yep. That's right.
100%. That's like you wear a Tyvek suit kind of a job.
Tyvek? With
Tyvek? Like, what's the, you know, the yellow hazmat suits kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Tyvek, I think, is just the trademark DuPont name, probably, for the material used often in those types of suits.
Ah.
Jack, your pooper scooper's comment got me off on a tangential thought. My dad used to work for a company that marketed a device called a super duper pooper scooper to use in cleaning up after your dogs.
Oh.
True story.
Nice. Super duper pooper scooper. Man, gotta love it.
Yep.
Well, we have now officially covered all three of the what if topics we each of us brought.
Covered them quite well, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I don't have any other thoughts to add. I think we did it justice.
I think so.
So With that all said, thanks again, Terry, for making time to join us today. We'll have to have you back.
My honor.
And thanks. Thank you, Jack, for putting together the intro sound clip.
The intro sound clip to what?
To Territories.
Territory.
And thank you to our audience for sticking with us through another tangent. As always, if you would like to submit an idea or join us as a guest yourself, feel free to use the online sign-up form, which is in the description of every episode and in our bio page. So as always, we'll talk to you next time. Take care.